Thank you very much. Thank you, John, for your interesting presentation. My name is Sabine Schels. I am responsible for fundamental commodity research at Bank of America Merrill Lynch. My responsibility is really for a wide array of energy commodities and also including the metals markets that we cover. What I was asked to do here today is give a bit of an overview over the European and UK gas price dynamics. But as you may have seen, if you've already run through some of the slides that were included there, for the next couple of minutes or so, over the next few slides, I will actually do everything but that. So please bear with me. I think if you look at the European gas price dynamics, it's really hard looking at the underlying supply-demand balance without having a more macro view and without really having also a view on oil. Because we do believe, and that will be one of the main conclusions that I'll make today, that the link to oil is still relatively strong, and the link to oil by European gas prices is still relatively strong. And therefore, I think it is important to include that in your assessment. As you see in this analysis, it's one of our favorite charts. It's a very simple chart, but it's one of our favorite analysis. When you look at the size of the energy sector in the global economy at the moment, and you go back a long time, so you sort of put that into perspective historically, what you very quickly see from this analysis is that the energy sector is taking up a very large share. And the other thing that you notice is that 9%, so every time the energy sector makes up 9% in the global economy, we have seen subsequently major episodes of demand destruction. So look at the oil price crisis in the early 80s. Look again at 2008, 2009, when we had a massive spike in oil prices, and also other energy commodities, of course. And in both instances, did we see a lot of demand destruction, and did we see the global economy fall into recession? I think the takeaway from this analysis is that the energy sector is very large at the moment. The upside to oil prices and gas prices, arguably, is quite limited from here. While we're not yet at that 9% demand destruction level, and that would probably be more like $135 to $140 a barrel, the upside in case of any further supply or demand shocks is probably pretty limited. Now, you may ask, why is it that we still continue to see a lot of this tightness in the energy markets, and particularly for oil, and one way we like to analyze this is by looking really at the supply trends for major commodities over the last 10 years. We have seen many of the commodity markets, the metals markets, the bulk commodity markets, undergo visit some massive supply changes over the last few years, where strong investment into productive capacity has seen a big pickup in supply growth, and many of these markets, iron ore, aluminum, coal being the extreme cases, are now extremely oversupplied, and they see very, very high inventories. When you move a little bit farther to the left in that chart, you see the global gas markets here, on average, in the past 10 years, supply growth expanded by something like 3% and fell way short of real GDP growth. So these markets are considerably tighter, and it also explains why Asian LNG markets are still relatively supported. But oil really is sitting at the extreme end with, average supply growth of just about 1 to 1.5%. Falling short not just of real GDP growth and really any other major commodity market out there, but even falling short of labor force and population growth. Of course, you can argue this is pretty backward-looking. We're looking at the past 10 years, but really, also looking into the future, we do think the supply growth in the oil market will remain quite limited and should be, about 1 to 1.5% per annum. Now, what about the demand side? Clearly, there are some major trends happening in the global energy markets, and efficiency is a key theme, not just for the European gas markets, and we'll talk about that in more detail later, but also for the oil markets. That doesn't mean to say that global GDP growth isn't anymore a major driver of energy and particularly oil demand. You know, when you look at this simple correlation here, you do see that, you know, lower structural GDP growth has over the last few years led to lower oil demand growth. And as we see a bit of a pickup in the next couple of years, that should also lead to higher demand for oil. But I think the more interesting takeaway probably is that we are now consistently below that red trend line. Unlike 2010, of course, where we saw a lot of stimulus, a lot of monetary and fiscal stimulus translating into huge demand, particularly by emerging markets, but also, you know, big oil demand recovery in the developed world. But I think, you know, the interesting thing really is that efficiency is starting to take hold also in the emerging markets and is translating into, you know, a lower oil demand growth per unit of GDP growth. Perhaps not more near term, you know, the one interesting thing that we're seeing, of course, is that the data has, you know, the macro data has recovered relatively quickly for US and also for Europe. So that's, you know, having gone through a prolonged period of contraction, we're finally seeing the PMIs moving into positive territory, and you're seeing that have an impact on oil demand growth. In fact, oil demand globally at the moment is led not by emerging markets, but is led by the developed world, which is a bit of a break in trend to what we have witnessed over the last few years. You know, U.S. demand for diesel, for instance, is very, very strong, growing at a rate of about 9% year on year over the last couple of weeks compared to last year. And likewise, we're seeing a similar trend in Europe where finally demand for industrial fuels is starting to recover. And by the way, a similar theme also for the gas markets. But perhaps one interesting theme that we're seeing at the same time is that we're witnessing at the same time is that the emerging markets are not really participating in this demand recovery. In fact, it really looks to us that the emerging markets are a little bit the weak link at this time around. If we were to see another supply disruption, whether it is by the you know, Libya or you know, any sort of issues with Iran or, you know, other Middle East or North African supply disruptions, it's likely that the demand destruction this time around will come from emerging markets. And part of that has to do with the fact that energy prices, oil, of course, also LNG, priced in local currencies are extremely, extremely high. In the case of oil, you know, with the very, very sharp devaluation in the Indian rupee or in the Indonesian rupiah and so on and so forth, oil prices in local currencies are much, much higher than they were at the peak in 2008. And again, similar theme for LNG. And as a result of that, we are seeing diesel demand growth starting to come down in major emerging markets. So we think this also will sort of limit the upside to oil prices in the near term. You know, of course, one other, you know, very interesting theme is the fact that, you know, the U.S. is producing so much oil and gas. I mean, it has really massively surprised the whole analyst community, I would argue, and it's also having huge benefits to U.S. economic growth. And in part, the reason why Bernanke is in a position to discuss, you know, whether to taper or not to taper, really comes from oil and gas production and the reduced need for imports, and in fact, higher exports of petroleum products. So when you look at both the oil and the gas trade balance for a group of countries, what you immediately see is how the U.S. sticks out. It's been able to completely turn around the trade balance for oil over the last few years, and it's, you know, the trade balance for gas is almost closed. Very different theme, of course, for Europe. Very different theme also for China. And of course, you know, in Japan, we have seen a continued very, very sharp deterioration in both the oil and gas trade balance. And in our view, this will really continue to put the US in a much better relative competitive position compared to all of these countries. Now, Japan, of course, you know, 2.5 years have passed since the disaster, since the earthquake, the tsunami, and the disaster at Fukushima. But really, the consequences of that are still being felt globally, because Japan, as you know, just shut its last nuclear power plant in the West without any timetable for restart, without nuclear power, which once fueled 30% of electricity demand. Japan's demand for all fossil fuels remains strong, but particularly so for LNG. On average, LNG imports into Japan this year are up about 25% compared to where they were before Fukushima. In July this year, we saw record seasonal high imports of LNG. And you know, on top of that, we are also seeing a lot of nuclear outages in other countries in Asia Pacific. A lot of outages in South Korea, where 6 out of 23 reactors are offline. And imports in August, on the back of that, were up 40%. Taiwan is also experiencing some nuclear problems. And into the whole Asian region, we just continue to experience that strong pull of LNG, with, again, nuclear capacity being constrained. And of course, on the other hand, also a need to continue to build inventories for the winter. So we continue to expect relatively strong LNG imports into the Pacific Basin, and that should, in our view, also support LNG prices, where, of course, we have already seen the impact of this strong pull being felt. Prices right now are trading in Asia, trading at almost $16 per MMBTU from $14.50 back in May. Now, what do we expect particularly for Japan? Because, as I will show you in a couple of slides, we really think this is very important for the European gas price dynamics. We've just revised our expectations for the nuclear capacity restart schedule and really decided that we had to push back a lot of these startups. Of course, on the one hand, you have these continued problems at Fukushima, where the groundwater is mixing with radioactive material. But I think, perhaps more importantly, the Nuclear Regulation Authority is completely in charge of this. The government has a more pro-business and pro-nuclear stance, but it's left this very political decision with that authority. We might see some approvals for restarts by the end of this year or next, but in fact, some of these approvals might be linked to further investment. So we don't know how long that could take. And in fact, a lot of the restarts themselves could take a little bit of time. So we continue to see LNG imports into Japan increasing this year relative to last. That's our expectation for the remainder of the year. But really, we think the restart schedule, also because of that strong public opposition, will be very slow. By the end of next year, we only see, maybe let me go back to the previous one, we only see 11 gigawatts of nuclear capacity in Japan. A lot of the restart is really going to be back-end loaded compared to our previous expectations, where we already had restarts sort of by the end of this year. And of course, 11 gigawatts is a far cry from the 49 gigawatts that we had prior to the crisis. So on a sort of year-on-year basis, we do continue to see LNG demand increasing this in the fourth quarter and also in the first half of next year, and really only in the second half will we see Japan taking a little bit less of liquid gas. So actually, the other point that I want to make is for next year, even though as a whole, even though we think there will be some restarts, we actually think LNG demand in Japan, LNG imports, can continue to increase because A, the economy is recovering, and B, there have been some sort of temporary energy saving and efficiency measures being implemented, which are unlikely to last as some of this capacity is coming back. So that, in our view, will make up for any nuclear restarts. And I think here our expectation is perhaps different to what other analysts are expecting. So finally, to come to the real topic that I've been asked to present here today, what does that mean for Europe? Or if you just look at a simple chart of European LNG imports over the last few years, you of course see this break in trend since 2011, when Europe really has not been able to compete anymore in the global market. We've seen a dramatic reversal of LNG flows into Europe since 2011, and flows are down on average annually by about 47 MCM per day since then. We've seen a lot of diversions into Asia, with Qatar really being the swing supplier in many cases. And a lot of this, of course, makes sense because the netback differential for Qatar, you know, between sending to Northwest Europe and between sending to the Pacific Basin is about $6 per MMBTU. The UK has been very hardly hit by this, of course, with imports down about 60% since 2011. You know, of course, the global LNG market could start to loosen up quite significantly if we get more supplies. We do think this will happen eventually in 2015-16. We see a lot of new projects starting up in Australia. But really, you know, this is an industry that has been prone to startup delays, that has been prone to cost overruns. So we really think for the next 2 years, we should still see a lot of support to Asian LNG prices. Now, of course, this LNG scarcity into Europe has been exacerbated also by the scarcity of indigenous supply. When you look at European, you know, total natural gas production, it has been in big declines. When you look at it for the UK, over the last 5 years alone, it halved down to 37 BCM. When you look at total European indigenous production and you exclude Norway, so you exclude the top bar here, the purple bar, you know, you see that actually production has fallen by about 20% over the last 5 years or 44 BCM. Now, Norway is, of course, is interesting because to some extent they've been able to cushion that blow a little bit, but not anymore. This year, we are also seeing sharp output declines in Norway, down about 6%. And as you may have already heard in the previous presentation, you know, some of this is, of course, due to temporary factors, and you know, that should improve again next year, hopefully. But really, most of it is linked to, you know, prolonged and unplanned outages at existing fields, especially Troll, which we think will continue, and also, you know, the underlying decline of the reservoir, and then of course also the government, which has been giving much lower permits this year to sort of preserve the reservoir integrity. So we do actually think, looking into and you know, going beyond this year, we will see Norway gas production perhaps stabilize at the current levels, but we really don't think there will be much increase from here. On top of that, we've had, you know, a sharp fall also in pipeline imports into the south, so from Algeria, from Libya. So really, you know, Europe very much had to rely on Russia, and Russia has come to Europe's rescue, no doubt. Production, after falling by about 2% last year, is now up 1% this year, and you know, that's of course very positive. And moreover, with gas demand actually in decline in Russia domestically this year, and also in parts of Eastern Europe, we've seen a huge pickup in pipeline flows to Western Europe. This summer, we're up almost 40% year on year in how much gas Europe is taking from Russia. So, you know, that's clearly very positive. But what's happening on the demand side, you know, no doubt European gas demand has seen significant improvement with, you know, demand in the first 9 months of the year up about 2.5%. But really, in our view, that has been due to weather. I mean, this, as we all know, it has been a very sharp, very long winter. And if you actually clean up the data for, you know, this abnormal weather, what you see is that on a weather-adjusted basis, demand actually fell by almost 2%. What we're also quite concerned about is that you continue to see this north-south divide. Germany has seen a real rebound in demand, but of course the south is still heavily declining. You know, we do think the outlook will continue to be quite challenging because, you know, on the one hand, the industrial economy in the periphery remains weak, and that's also our call from a macro basis. Yes, Europe is recovering, but, you know, demand, we expect GDP growth of not even 1% next year, so it's a very, very slow and drawn out recovery. And then if you look at the power sector, of course, we continue to see a lot of switching to coal with German spark spreads negative out to 2015. And also efficiency, like I mentioned before, there is, of course, rising efficiency, which is also pulling demand lower. So actually next year, we think demand totally in Europe will decline by almost 5 BCM. So it remains a very challenging outlook. When you listen to all this, you may say, how do we get to such a tight gas market, really, with such a weak outlook for demand? But when you put it into perspective, so here what we're saying is, let's look at the total decline in demand and in supply since 2009. You very quickly see that indigenous supply is falling even faster than demand. Demand declined by about 11 BCM over this time period. Indigenous supply outside Norway declined by about 23, so almost double that. You include LNG and all the loss in pipeline inflows from the south, and all of a sudden you're down 44 BCM. And then when you include Norway and Russia, yes, we've improved a little bit the net picture, but I think it's pretty quickly apparent that the demand decline is nowhere near as bad as the supply decline is. So net, Europe as a whole is becoming more dependent on Norway and more dependent on Russia. 10 years ago, these two countries made up about 38% of the market, and now they're taking 48%. And that in turn means the domestic market is structurally tight. We see that, of course, in inventories, which partly as a result of also the cold winter, remain very low. Post winter, they were the lowest in 4 years. We have seen very strong rebuilds, no doubt, but still, gas inventories in Europe as a whole remain far. And these here, by the way, we include the countries that we think are important for Northern Europe and are important for the UK. So, overall, they are at levels that are much lower than what we used to for this time of the year. Northern France alone has a deficit of about 1 BCM. Germany 1.5 BCM. We need to inject for Europe as a whole about 1.5 BCM up to the 1st of November to bring storage to normal levels. So net, and here's the picture for Germany, net, what that means is we need continued strong inflows from Russia, with Norway declining, with LNG not being there and unlikely to appear anytime soon. We grow a lot more reliant on Russian gas imports. What does that mean for prices? Well, prices obviously have been very, very elevated. You look at prices for this winter, and you look at prices for the following winter. They've traded sort of in a high range for quite a while and have now broken below 70 p per therm. In our view, the downside really is capped, given A, the weak storage position, which we're unlikely to fix in the short term, and B, the continued reliance on Russian gas imports, which, of course, come largely at oil-linked levels. So, we have seen summer prices this year also really surprisingly elevated, and the forward curve also for 2014 is pretty high. But we do think this is justified. And in fact, if we are seeing any unexpected, unplanned outages in the short term, any unplanned supply outages, there is, of course, the potential for further spikes. And then more structurally, when you look at the link, which we've done here for TTF gas, to an average oil-linked formula into Europe, so this includes both Norway and Russia, what you quickly see is, as I mentioned at the beginning, the link is still very strong. Oil is still an important price setter for gas. In fact, we can also test for that quantitatively, and we find oil prices are grandeur causing TTF and BP gas prices, and continue to do so. And we do think that link with oil will remain. And on the back of, I think, the tightness that we see structurally in the market, we still think there is probably some further upside to prices in the medium term. I think I will stop it here, and perhaps we open it up for questions. Thank you very much for your attention.